sure that many of you have come across the teachings of Ajahn Chah, one of the early Thai forest tradition teachings. And particularly the teaching where he says, if you let go a little, you'll have a little peace. If you let go a lot, you'll have a lot of peace. And if you let go completely, you'll have complete peace. It's curious to me the way this phrase, let go, has so woven itself into the insight meditation culture. My children in their early years spent quite a bit of time in retreat centers, and this is one of the first phrases they learnt. Actually much to their benefit and often to my disadvantage. That whenever I had reason to reprimand them or say no to something, I would get the response, Mom, don't you think it's time to let go? But it is a curious phrase because it's not one you actually find in the early texts. There are other words that I use. Relinquishment, unbinding, particularly is used a lot, unbinding the heart. And of course, the other word that is used with a great deal of frequency is renunciation. And I sometimes wonder if we find these words somehow harsh or unacceptable somehow to us. And so we've introduced or produced this rather softer sounding phrase of let go. I have a friend who every time she takes a flight, every time she flies, she tells me she worries. She worries before she gets on the plane. She worries the entire time of the flight. And, you know, to her mind, understandably, this is quite an unnatural phenomenon. And she also tells herself that it's very painful to worry. She really experiences the painfulness of that worrying. And she tells herself that she really should let go. But then there's another part that says to herself, but after all, somebody needs to worry. And if nobody worried, what would keep this plane up in the air? And if everybody didn't worry, we wouldn't be safe. And it really struck me when she told me that this story, how much it really does describe our human dilemma. We all actually know experientially, emotionally, and repeatedly the painfulness of clinging and holding and grasping. We know in those moments there's so little happiness present, so little peace of heart present. And the outcome is usually the same. It's just more of the tendency and the habit of clinging to things. We know it delivers, clinging delivers a quality of contractedness and anxiety into our life that really does leech the joy from our lives. And everybody here has probably told themselves countless times, more times than you can even remember, that it would be a good idea to let go. We've even turned it into a kind of inner command system. You know, let go, let go, let go. And yet you have perhaps noticed, well, has anybody been very successful? We probably actually really notice how ineffective that scolding is. And it turns into a kind of scolding voice, doesn't it? A kind of reprimand voice. When we tell ourselves in the midst of an obsession or a rumination or an emotional storm and we tell ourselves let go, there really seems to hardly hold any difference or make any difference. And, you know, perhaps for us too, we may hold an underlying belief system that tells us that it is our clinging or it is our grasping that keeps people close to us. That it might be our grasping that protects us from loss or from our world crumbling, that somehow it's our clinging and our grasping that protects others in some unseen way from danger or from uncertainty or from the unknown. We may even, and it's a possibility, we may even at times mistake clinging for connectedness. There's a simple reality, I think, in all of our lives that we actually have been asked to relinquish, to unbind, to let go countless times. And we know that that is often what is necessary for us to live this life fully. Rather than being preoccupied with the anxieties about the future or the past that has gone by that we cannot change or undo, that to live this life fully, we actually really need to inhabit this moment. And clinging and grasping is a major deterrent to inhabiting this moment fully. We also know that we live a life where many things do let go of us. People come in and out of our lives, the things that have passed away, the things that we have lost, the things that have changed, not always in ways that we would have predicted or welcomed. I think that the Buddha really did propose a very simple formula, that clinging and grasping and holding are experiences that are laced with suffering. In themselves, they are experiences of emotional suffering, and that they lead to greater suffering. And the formula that the degree of freedom and the degree of liberation, the degree of happiness and peace that we can know in this life is tied, or is very much equal to the degree that we find in ourselves the capacity to unbind. To unbind our hearts. In the Buddhist teaching of liberation, I think it is taught in a very uncompromising way that renunciation and unbinding are really central to a path of happiness and a path of freedom. But it is framed in a very particular way that renunciation is a very profound gesture of compassion. It's a very profound gesture of care. It's a gesture of compassion for ourselves, for others, for the world around us, and indeed for our planet. As I mentioned earlier, renunciation is very much put forward as one of the three wise intentions interwoven with kindness and compassion, that it's guided by a life of integrity, of relatedness. And I think as we practice here and in many ways walk our own path and investigate and embrace this teaching, and perhaps just a little bit learn to trust in our own capacity for profound inner freedom, it's important to recognize that we are actually part of a renunciate tradition. We're part of a renunciate teaching, a renunciate community, a renunciate lineage. I don't know how that lands for you. Whether you hear that and think, well, not me, you know, maybe everybody else, but, you know, not me. Because when we look at actually what we're doing in the practice, on a very real level, we're learning moment to moment to unbind our hearts from confusion, from entanglement, from fear. And this is a path and a practice of renunciation. that leads very directly to understanding. And you know, this quality of renunciation, and I quite like it if you could in some measure kind of naturalize this word and not entirely think of it as something alien, and maybe strip some of the associations away from it that you might have that are unhelpful. But insight and renunciation are said to be also interwoven, that our capacity to unbind our minds and hearts from confusion and panic and terror and craving really is a process of unlayering, isn't it? Pretty much a process of unlayering. And as that unlayering happens, inevitably, well, it brings us closer to the actualities of this life that we live, the actualities that lie underneath all the camouflage, all the embroidery, all the embellishment, that unlayering is actually leading us to be more fully aligned in our hearts, our minds, our lives, with the kind of core actualities of human experience. All human experience, universal experience. And sometimes, you know, from a perspective of fear or from a perspective of defensiveness or denial, those core actualities of human experience, of universal experience, feel very frightening. And in a way, they feel almost unpalatable, which is why we spend so much time actually trying to get away from them. But they cannot be gotten away from, because the core actualities of human experience, of existence, actually permeate all things that are born. There, as the Buddha put it, there is unsatisfactoriness that asks to be understood. There is the unarguable reality of change and instability from which none of us are exempt that asks to be embraced. And there is the question, the enduring question of self and non-self that we are all invited to explore and to investigate in a very honest way. Your renunciation, I think I understand why it's a difficult word to embrace and a very difficult quality to embody, because I think when we hear it, it somehow holds these echoes of coldness or disassociation or disconnection or being kind of life-denying. And there's this curious paradox in the history of this path, that the Buddha puts renunciation and relatedness and interconnectedness side by side and interwoven. Even in the forms of the monastic life, where, you know, nuns and monks would actually, you know, give up so much in terms of material possession and status and role and live this very kind of, in many ways, a very austere and renunciate life. And yet, within the Vinaya, or the rules of training, the Buddha put it so clearly that monastics needed to relate, be in the world. It never allowed them to kind of disappear into caves, and the way that he disallowed that was by kind of enshrining the alms round into the daily monastic life. You know, it was a life of connectedness, a life of interrelatedness, and yet a life of this kind of renunciation in the midst of all of that. And I think that is a dilemma and a question for us in our lay lives, because we clearly long for relatedness, we long for connectedness, we long for intimacy and the richness of affection and care and love in our lives. We are relational beings. And yet it also seems that to really live very fully as a relational being, we also need to know what it means to be alone. that we need to know what it means to relinquish dependency and views of insufficiency in order to live that life very fully. And at first, I think renunciation can at first glance almost seem to imply a not caring, a getting rid of things. But clearly this is not what is meant. And then, of course, there's a basic reality of just how hard we do find it to really let go of anything at all. You know, what a challenge that seems to be for us, and how embedded the emotional patterns of clinging and grasping and contractedness really feel to be in our lives. And you know, to get a taste of that, we actually only need to look back over our day today, or to look back over any single day. And we see that kind of surge of clinging, and it has no conscience, does it? I mean, we can take hold of a sight, a sound, a thought, the idea of lunch, about, you know, the plan for tomorrow, you know, the idea of another person, that it seems to be this ongoing momentum to close down around things, to contract around things, to cling to things that arise. And we see it outside in our lives, you know, our hopes, our roles. My space is a big one, isn't it? You're in my space. We don't even know that we're clinging to my space till somebody sits on our chair. And then we got that's my space. You know, and this feeling of how kind of pervasive it can be. And we could also, you know, really feel kind of flummoxed, I think, to consider what a life without clinging might look like. And we could even wonder, you know, what would get us out of bed in the morning? You know, what would get us to sort of, you know, really be committed to a particular aspiration or idea or creativity? You know, what would move us to move through the world? And I think the idea of a life without clinging can feel so unknown that it can even seem fearful, that what would we lean upon? How would we know ourselves? How would we know another? But I think it really is so important as we reflect on this very, very central theme in this teaching of liberation, to be absolutely crystal clear about what is being unbound, what is being relinquished, what is renunciation really speaking about? Because it's not about relinquishing the people we love and care about. It's not about relinquishing aspiration. It's not about relinquishing this life or this full and vibrant world of the senses. It's actually learning to renounce suffering and the causes of suffering. It's learning to relinquish struggle and torment and the causes of struggle and torment. It's learning to relinquish the sorrow of the contracted and feeling and fearful heart and all of the afflictive emotions that can be experienced. And there is no vacuum. Nature abhors a vacuum. There is never a vacuum. The relinquishing of one thing is what allows for the arising of something else. The cultivation of one thing is what allows the relinquishment of another. So renunciation is really in the service of relinquishing the afflictive, so that the loveliness, the genuine loveliness of spaciousness, of calmness, of kindness, of peace, of serenity, truly can flourish. I think one of the great essences of the Buddhist teaching is really to the invitation, the encouragement to love the freedom of the heart that is unbound. I have to say, in my experience, renunciation as a command structure absolutely does not work. And in my experience, there's really no relinquishing, no unbinding without understanding and without insight. That we might say that, you know, relinquishment is a natural embodiment of insight. That without understanding or insight, all that we're left with is a command structure that often has threads of control and aversion running through it. Because often when we tell ourselves to let go of something, we can hear that tone of aversion or control or scolding of should. You know, I should let go of this. I need to get rid of this, or I need to get out of this. And I think in that kind of aversion-based command structure, we're probably not letting go at all. I think we've kind of missed the point. And actually, what we're doing is putting rejection and aversion into a more enlightened language. And rejection and aversion, I think denial, are all kind of like the near enemies of renunciation. It's that kind of pushing away, that should, have to get rid of. It's like the shadow side, you know. And we're often, what we're doing in that is kind of trying to walk away from or turn our backs on what we feel that we cannot bear or tolerate or accommodate. You know, and I saw this many times, you know, in the early years of practicing in Asia, you know, where someone would get upset with someone else, you know, and kind of say, well, you know, I'm renouncing this, you know, and it's really just turning the back, you know, it's just turning away from. So in the understanding upon which renunciation rests is really the very deep insight into the way things actually are. We're asked to align our hearts again and again in our lives with the kind of core actualities, the simple truths, the core realities of every moment, because that's a life of peace. That's a life when we're not in a state of resistance or rejection or denial. And of course, when you know, this phrase is used a lot in Buddhist teaching, the way things actually are, you know, and it sounds kind of ideological, you know, the way things actually are. but actually, the Buddha very much kind of unpacked this, and I referred to this yesterday. The way that I phrase it is about the unarguables of every human life. That which is unarguable, that which we cannot be in a state of argument with, that every time we're in a state of argument with the unarguables, we're in a state of contention and conflict. So the unarguables are fairly obvious to all of us, you know, the realities, the actualities of loss, of pain. The actuality is that nothing really stands still for us or is actually graspable. And the exceeding difficulty in finding any enduring or reliable me. And so much of the struggle and the turmoil that we do experience in this life is born not of these unarguables, but in fact with the argument that we're having with them. I mean, in the unarguables, you know, in loss, in separation, of course there's sadness. Of course there is heartache at times. But much of our actual turmoil is born of our reactions to the unarguables. And this is actually where there can be a good deal of dissonance in our life, isn't it so? That in a very real way, we all know this. You know, we know nothing's graspable. We know nothing will stand still for us. We know that we are all mortal. We know that the landscape of loss and change. I mean, we all know this. And yet this is the place often where we're kind of trying to pretend it's not so. And to live our lives as if it's not so. And this is where this dissonance keeps, you know, keeps the mind in a state of unease. It keeps the heart in a state of discontent. Now, renunciation, I think, is really concerned with healing that dissonance. And in that healing, bringing an end to so much of the torment that is in truth optional. And there is much that is delightful in this life. In a moment to moment through our days, we are touched by the lovely. You know, the sun when it beams through the clouds, you know, a lovely meal, the people who care about us. On occasion, even now and then, really quite a lovely sitting or a lovely walking period. We know the loveliness of being cared for, but there's a good deal that's not so pleasant in all of our lives. It's painful, uncomfortable, not getting what we want, even if it's the last grape at lunch that disappears before our eyes. You know, the sitting where there's a sort of failure of expectation. The difficult people, the illnesses, the aging, the pain of all the losses that we're asked to embrace in this life. I mean, this is a very personal reality felt by each of us. In our own ways, that needs our response and our compassion and our care. But it's also a universal reality. You look around every single person in this room will have their own measure of affliction. Will be asked to meet their own losses. Will ask to be asked to adjust to the changes in their own bodies, their own health. And I have come to see very, very much in my own life that my relationship to pleasure and my relationship to pain, my relationship to the pleasant and to the unpleasant, really in a way comes to define my life. And it comes to define who I feel myself to be. And it comes to define, too, how I engage with the world around me. If I only fear pain or the unpleasant, if I only know the mechanisms of resisting it, denying it, pushing it away, if I only know how to react to the unpleasant or the painful with aversion, my life will surely become agitated. Contracted. I will come to define myself as a person who is incapable, who is fearful, who is extremely vulnerable. And I will have a waterfall of thinking around that. You know, all the things, all the ways, the strategies that I need to engage in to avoid the unpleasant, to avoid the painful. And this will certainly be behaviorally reflected. If I only know how to relate to the pleasant with grasping, this will also come to define who I believe myself to be and how I live my life. It will mean splitting the world endlessly into friends and into enemies. It will mean that even the loveliness of the sunset or the loveliness of a meal will be followed by those next steps of how do I keep this, how do I maintain this. I will be planning my tomorrow endlessly and not living my today. And I will come to believe that I am incapable of tolerating that which is not pleasant. And I think this is such a kind of a worthy reflection for our lives, how our own relationship to the pleasant and the unpleasant, much of which we cannot control or govern, actually really does come to define who we believe ourselves to be and how we live our lives. Also, it is also true that our infatuation with all of those strategies of pursuing the pleasant, avoiding the unpleasant, it certainly contracts our world, doesn't it, around the centralization of me, my fears and my wants. And then so limits actually our capacity to see the universality of this human story and to reach out to it with compassion, with kindness, with care, with integrity. There's not so much freedom in that world. The fear that my world, well, my life will crumble if I don't succeed in maintaining and holding on to the pleasant. The fear that my life, my being will crumble if I'm exposed to the unpleasant. I think to understand wisdom, I mean to understand freedom, we're really asked to explore our willingness, to have the willingness to explore how, what the foundations of clinging and grasping actually are, what our own relationship to the pleasant and the unpleasant actually is. And it's a genuine reflection, this is like the homework of a day and like the homework of a lifetime. Now, it's interesting how we do tend to kind of segment the teaching, you know. So we see here's craving, here's aversion, here's clinging. But actually, in Buddhist psychology, these are continuums. They're not something separate. Clinging and grasping, we're asked to understand, is only an intensification and a continuum of craving and aversion. It's not something separate and apart. I mean, you can feel that, you know, if something happens on retreat, somebody slightly irritates you, you know, and, you know, maybe they shuffled a bit too much for your liking, or have a few too many coughs for your liking. You know, the world is full of these irritations we feel, isn't it? And you can feel the kind of flinch, can't you? The aversion, you know. Sit still, you know. And then pretty soon you can feel, actually, you know, you're waiting for the next fidget. You're actually waiting for the next cough. You know, and the aversion has moved into this clinging, into this grasping, but also that person has been solidified into a view that is clung to, and I've actually been solidified in that moment into a view of myself. I mean, you can see it around something pleasant, you know, maybe there was something nice on the lunch table you really rather liked, and you know, in genuine humility and restraint, you only took one. You said, oh, well, that was nice. And then he left over there. And you could feel, you know, how the appreciation of the pleasant starts to morph into something different, doesn't it? Like a little more of that. Oh, there are some that. We start to strategize and we kind of go, I really, really want that. You know, I really, really need that. And you can just feel that continuum, can't you? How the craving is actually just intensifying, magnifying, becoming a clinging until the point is I feel I'm just going to have a disastrous afternoon unless I manage to get that second chocolate cookie or whatever it is, you know. My whole day will be ruined. This is the continuum. Now, in my own experience, we're very rarely short of opportunities to explore our reactions of craving and aversion. And it's not a demand that they don't arise, they do. But then it's an invitation to understand those impulses. What does it feel like to be in a state of craving? The sense of lack, the sense of something missing, the sense of something not enough. What does it actually feel like to be in a state of aversion? Contractedness, not wanting, fearing, pushing away. And to really be able to quite honestly to ask ourselves, is there any happiness? Is there any peace in the midst of this? Is there balance? Is there spaciousness? Is there kindness? Is there confidence? Is there a sense of freedom? And I think we could take questions like these into all of the moments when craving and aversion is beginning to arise, beginning to escalate, and to beginning to intensify into craving, because this may be a key to understanding what renunciation is. It may be a key to understanding what unbinding is, how this is actually a practice of happiness and peace in the service of happiness and peace. That renunciation is not a punishment modality. It is not a deprivation mode. It is actually a practice of freedom. Now, it is also my experience that renunciation, even if we use the phrase letting go, this is not something we do. It is an embodiment of an understanding of the universal realities, particularly of impermanence. Simple fact is that the reality of impermanence, which I'm sure nobody here argues with, right? Nobody has any argument with this. We're all in agreement. It happens. But the reality is that the simple truth of impermanence permeating all experience, all phenomena, all impressions, makes a mockery of clinging. It makes a mockery of grasping. It is no wonder, that grasping is so unsuccessful in producing stability. This doesn't even logically, intellectually kind of marry up. You know, because this is what grasping is the service of often, is producing some kind of stability. And yet it doesn't logically make any sense, does it? That this is somehow going to protect us from change. Now, the unarguable nature of impermanence means that nothing in this life is graspable. And how easily we know this and we suffer these prolonged bouts of amnesia. I mean, we can all have deep and philosophical discussions about the reality of change. But it's not so easy for us to live in the light of impermanence, is it? I mean, insight actually has implications, and the implications of insight is the invitation to align our lives and our thinking and our way of seeing with those insights that are present. I mean, as long as there's that dissonance between our insights and the living the light of their implications, we're basically going to find ourselves in trouble again and again. Now, impermanence is an unarguable, but we have an emotional relationship to it, don't we? I mean, when there's changes that we welcome, impermanence is really fantastic. I mean, the end of a root canal, we are so happy. A difficult neighbor moves away, this is such good news, We come out of an emotional obsession and just feel the bubble burst, and there's such a sense of relief. And, we could all become advocates of impermanence in that moment, We want to tell the world. But we have an emotional relationship to changes that we don't welcome. Also, this we often experience as loss, as being deprived of something, of an ending that we can't welcome. So part of this practice clearly is understanding that emotional relationship and how much our sense of self is actually being built upon our ability to maintain the things that we want to maintain and get rid of the things that we don't want to maintain. So clinging or grasping is the kind of mechanism that we pretty much unconsciously use to pretend or to somehow protect ourselves from the changes that we can't embrace. to protect ourselves from loss, to protect ourselves from the changes that we feel are painful. And sometimes change is painful. Separation from those that we love is indeed painful. And yet clinging is a real diversion, isn't it, from actually embracing that pain with compassion. Sometimes we even tell ourselves that loss is our kind of a failure, that our inability to make something stay the same is a kind of personal failure. Now, there is a way in which this sense of clinging, grasping is such an important exploration, because it is something we impose not upon only upon experiences and events. We impose it upon other people, and we impose it upon ourselves. We can have such fixed perceptions about things, such fixed views about other people. You know that shuffling neighbor? You know, next time you come on a retreat, you only need to see them, and you're sitting somewhere way on the other side of the room, because that's who they are, you know? And how we go, and how much our world is divided by clinging to fixed views about others. You know, they are so terrible. They are so ignorant. You know, they are so aggressive. You know, they are so hostile. And I can almost think of no greater gift of compassion than to liberate another person and to liberate ourselves from our fixed views and perceptions that I clung to. Because this is extended not only outwardly. This is one of our major forms of self-imprisonment. You know, I am this kind of person. You know, I am hopeless. I am unworthy. I am unlovable. I am unacceptable in some way. The way that we imprison ourselves and prevent others and ourselves from being the fluid, changing, unfolding beings that each of us actually is. When the Dalai Lama teaches about impermanence, he often encourages people to reflect on what has already disappeared. There's a lot, isn't there? For some, it might be their youth. Can you think of some of the interests that you've been so passionate about at times in your life that are now gone? I'm sure many of you have had the experience of the family photographs that have kind of traced your life, you know, and you see yourself, you know, that time when you were a kind of a passionate hippie, you know, and then the time you were passionately involved with this, and then the time you were passionately involved in that. I just think it's gone. It's actually gone. Think of all of the experiences you've had in this life which have just disappeared. They're gone. Think of the countless thoughts each one of us has had and how it's disappeared. Think about the things sometimes that have been so frightening for us in our life. And it's no longer there. It's part of our past. The last sitting is gone. The last walking, the last thought, the last breath. Gone. Some unhappily so, and some happily so. Imagine what our life would be like if this was not so. If we'd successfully grasped all of the events and thoughts and experiences, we wouldn't be able to bear it. Suzuki Roshi once said that, you know, renunciation is not getting rid of the things of the world, it is accepting that they pass away. There's no aversion within that. Now, clinging and grasping, it's essentially this futile endeavor to deny the reality of change, to argue with the unarguable. And it so sets us at odds with the way things actually are. And it's no wonder that it can cause so much suffering and pain. And what would it be really like for us to live with a very deep acceptance that all things will pass away, including me? it would, I think, perhaps feel like a kind of grace. It wouldn't mean that we love less or care less or less creative, but it might mean that we struggle less. These are, I think they are difficult, challenging lessons for us to learn and also to embody, because craving, aversion, clinging, grasping seems to happen so fast. That movement from openness to contractedness, it seems to happen so quickly that it feels almost like visceral, like a place where there's no choice. Yet I think our lives do keep asking us to learn the lessons of unbinding, the lessons of renunciation. And these lessons are really no more than aligning our hearts and minds and our view with the way things actually are in this moment. So often relinquishing the shoulds, relinquishing the craving, relinquishing the aversion, and to know this is as it is. That's not a statement of passivity. That's a beginning. That's a beginning. It's a beginning of engagement. It's a beginning often of skillful effort. It's often a beginning of compassion. It's a beginning of care, where none of that happens in the world of should. None of that happens in the world of the argument. Now, renunciation has another area of concern, which is actually this domain of understanding, or the question of self and non-self, anatta. Now, again, I would really encourage you not to hear non-self as some sort of ideological statement. But it's an invitation to investigate. Because underlying many of our emotional and psychological processes, underlying most of our world of reactivity, and underlying many of the choices we make, and certainly underlying the whole impulse of clinging and grasping, there is a belief system about me. There is a centralization of an enduring self, that this is me, this is mine, this belongs to me, this is who I am, which is why the loss feels so unbearable. Now, this idea of the centralized self, you know, the centralized me, so reliant upon what is clung to and grasped hold of, actually built upon what has been clung to and grasped hold of, and defined as being mine, whether it is in our emotional world or our physical world. This is actually the definition of me, isn't it? What has been clung to or grasped hold of often. There is a belief system, often there is a belief system also of insufficiency, that grasping is reassuring us that I am enough, I have something, I am someone, I have hold of something. And it is often covering up that kind of underlying kind of belief system of insufficiency, a culture of lack. And, you know, my suggestion would be that this culture of lack, this culture of insufficiency, essentially manifests as craving and aversion and clinging. I am my body, my past, my thoughts, my emotions, my roles, all that I have accumulated and become. We don't even know how powerful this belief system is until somehow there's a threat of part of that being taken away. And then we can hear that sort of voice of inner panic that says, I'm losing part of myself. I'm losing part of myself. Structure, my self-construction. Now, renunciation is not concerned with erasing the self. It is concerned with releasing the clinging to the view of self. And actually, it is really hard to find
a self apart from a view. The view of who I am. The view of what I am. And I think as long as this kind of central domain of clinging remains unquestioned, then basically craving, aversion, and grasping has a license to continue to govern our lives. Now, the view of self is also not emotionally neutral. Sometimes it's built around aversion, isn't it? I have what we call a negative view of self. A negative self, you know, built around what I don't like, you know, what I don't like in my body, what I don't like in my appearance, what I don't like in my experiences, our emotions. We form a view, and usually that view of self that's built around aversion gets articulated in the voice of judgment, or what we call judgment, you know. I'm terrible, I'm a failure, I'm incompetent, I'm clumsy, I'm not good enough. Sometimes this story is being told to us by others, and sometimes we just tell the story to ourselves. Other times the view of self is actually very much built around, has its roots in craving, again, around body, emotions, thoughts, a good meditation, I'm absolutely terrific, you know. Success, you know, a bad meditation, I'm a hopeless yogi, you know, a good meditation, I'm on the road to a Dharma teacher, you know, I'm a terrible mother, I'm a wonderful mother, you know, I'm a terrible friend, I'm a terrific friend. Again, it's often built around craving. Now, when, you know, I often feel like too much too much razzmatazz is made around anatta or non-self, you know. In terms of Buddhist psychology, this was kindergarten teaching. This was not something reserved for the sixth day of a retreat, you know, or after someone sat for a month, you know. For the Buddha, this was a very practical exploration. You know, it wasn't something esoteric or exotic. It was something just born of a few moments of introspection and examination inwardly. You know, and I think rather than getting all kind of razzmatazzy around non-self, it'd be a better use of time to find a self that is enduring and reliable and steady, wake up in the morning with one and go to bed with the same one at night. Find the one you had in childhood that's still maintaining today. You know, and it would be much better use of time to actually just find a self. Find the one you can rely on, the one that stands up to all scrutiny, the one that never changes its shape, the one that's consistent. Coherent. That would be useful. Because it's almost like when we hear anatta, it's like somebody's trying to convince us of something, whereas actually it'd be much better if we looked in our own experience and said, well, gosh, you know, I'll do my best. I'm going to find one. I'm going to find me. A lot of us went to Asia in the 70s to find ourselves. Not very successfully, must be said, but we see it how this changing view of me, don't we? The sad me at breakfast time feels very different than the contented me in a later sitting. You know, the contented self of a moment feels very different, is felt very different, and sees the world actually very differently than the discontented self at dinner time. You know, the calm me, you know, enjoying the moment feels very different than the agitated me rushing for the train. It's not only that the view of me is changing, but as the view of me is changing, so too is the view of the world. It's changing alongside that view of me. And how that is happening countless times in a single day. So what is really kind of shifting here is the view. And the kind of the clinging that is supporting that view. Because you notice when there's clinging to one view of me, it is very amnesic that it's ever been any different. You know, the agitated me rushing for the train imagines a lifetime of agitated me's rushing for trains. You know, if it's clung to. It has no memory even of the calm me of an hour earlier. That just seems like, oh, that wasn't really me. That's why we say, oh, that wasn't me. You know, that wasn't myself. Because, I mean, the way the mind is wired, actually, to build around the imperfect and to build around the negative and to bring it, build around the broken. Now, what we actually see in the view of self is the same impermanence, the same reality of change that touches everything else. And actually what we see is process. The process of selfing. And a process of selfing that gets interrupted and seems to get frozen in place basically by the mechanism of clinging to a view. So, you know, in terms of aligning ourselves with the unarguables, this is not about transporting ourselves to some exotic domain of non-self. But aligning our understanding with this process of selfing that is being shaped and reshaped and formed and reformed through a world of conditions, moment to moment through our day, and how grasping comes in and interrupts a process or puts a label or a name upon a process and turns a process into a thing, into a me. Now, what is interesting, many of you have practiced for a long time and you've undertaken the endeavor to find an enduring me unsuccessfully. And yet we still experience these moments of clinging, these moments of grasping, these moments of self-construction. And, you know, in many ways for many people in their practice, they have at least come to a philosophical agreement with the reality that there is no fixed, enduring, independent self. You know, at least philosophically, we've got there. You know, which is great. You know, it's wonderful. But at the same time, we see the process of grasping going on. So for me, here is the great puzzle. This is when we tell ourselves we should let go. We see the formation of, you know, I am like this, and we tell ourselves, I should let go of this. So even despite this kind of like, it deep inner investigation where there's nothing standing still in terms of self, this process of selfing, in moments of clinging, we tell ourselves to let go, which is really actually only another way of saying or imagining that despite our understanding of impermanence and process and unfoldment and conditions, we still imagine there's some kind of like little autonomous self in here that's going to creep up in moments of grasping and let go. That has the autonomy to let go. That has that ability to let go. Is it any wonder it doesn't work? It's no wonder it doesn't work. So, I mean, I think this is actually something very important to understand. That, you know, there's not another self that is going to let go of this self that I don't like. There's not an independent self that has that power, authority, autonomy, control to kind of step forward in moments of need and let go. It's why it doesn't work. So what the Buddha actually proposed was something completely different. What he is actually proposing is there are conditions inwardly that incline the mind towards grasping and selfing. And the conditions that incline the mind and heart towards grasping and selfing are the conditions of craving and aversion. And remember, craving and aversion also are family creatures. You know, they come with agitation, they come with impatience, they come with judgment, they come with need, you know, and projection. So craving and aversion are the conditions for clinging. So what the Buddha proposed, that in this world of endlessly changing conditions and process, that we actually set our hearts upon cultivating the conditions that incline the heart towards relinquishment. So that rather than thinking, I let go, or it's my job to let go, which will be endlessly ineffective, we actually set our hearts and minds upon the conditions
which are conducive to unbinding and relinquishment. Those are not complicated. The conditions of calm abiding, the conditions of kindness, conditions of compassion, the conditions of investigation, the conditions of listening inwardly, the conditions of mindfulness, that these are the conditions which incline the heart towards unbinding, which goes back to what I referred to earlier on in the day, knowing those moments when a difficult thought just sticks, because the conditions are prime for that sticking. Knowing another moment when the conditions of the heart are completely different, the same thought doesn't stick. Because it is the relinquishing, it is those conditions that are relinquishing, and not as an act of will, and not as an act of command. So in a sense, this is, I think, actually a great relief. You know, because in a way we can feel so unsuccessful in our efforts to let go and our commands, that, you know, we actually learn something from that and say, you know, perhaps we kind of missed the point somewhere. You know, and perhaps actually this is something very available. This is something very accessible. This is something very achievable, actually, to cultivate the conditions of non-stickiness. And those are actually the lessons, really, of liberating the moment. They're the lessons of unbinding. And in reality, they are the lessons of the path. You know, if I can actually be able to say to myself with some actually genuine acknowledgement that I have never let go of anything in my entire life, you know, and that's great. But actually, I also know that I have never clung to anything in my entire life. And those two go together. Those kind of statements, you know, the statements that I cling, I let go, these are the assumptions of a centrality and an autonomy of an independent self-existence, which are, in our own experience, we see not to be true. We see not to be so. It is why we really describe this as a path of cultivation, because the cultivation is the relinquishment. You know, the cultivation of kindness is the relinquishment of ill will. The cultivation of calm abiding is a relinquishment of agitation. You know, the cultivation of investigation is a relinquishment of confusion. And in a sense, it's almost at times, you know, we need to kind of frame and reframe our pathway and what it's actually dedicated to. And, you know, within that, there comes, I think, this natural alignment, the putting down the argument with the unarguables. Then I think also we really do live in the light of the understandings that are already with us. The understandings that we already really do know. Okay, so if we have just a moment quietly together, and then we have a little